Good evening to all of you. Thank you for that song. I was wondering as we sang that song, if I were to ask each of you here, what a mighty God we serve, who all believes that with all their heart? Because when we're done, I hope that from this story that all of you can realize that we serve a God that's just the same as in the Bible, and he does miracles just the same as he does in the Bible, and he answers prayer. And singing also was a huge part of being down there in the camp and keeping ourselves encouraged through singing and prayer. So a little background before I actually get into the story of what happened. Some people will ask me the question of, did you ever feel like you were down in Haiti? You were kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time. The answer to that question is no. Because of a situation that happened regarding my passport. So my dad got an email from Cam probably a couple weeks before I headed down to Haiti, telling that Cam needed two young men to volunteer to go down and help rebuild homes destroyed by the earthquake earlier in the year. And that was something that I was interested in. And so I told Dad that I would be interested in doing that, but I had a problem that seemed insurmountable at that time, and that was the simple fact that I had no passport. My passport had expired in April of last year, and as the procrastinator that I am, I had put off renewing it and sent it in to be renewed on August 13. And it was about 2 weeks afterwards that I got this notification from Cam asking for a volunteer to go do that. And according to what the internet said at the time, the expected wait time for a passport renewal was 12 to 15 weeks. I had not expedited it at all because at that point I didn't feel like I was going to need it. I didn't have any trips planned, so I didn't feel like I was going to need it. So I told Dad that, well, I don't have a passport, and more than likely it's not supposed to come till sometime in November. And this was the end of August when this started happening. And so Dad contacted Cam, and Cam contacted me, and we talked about it, and Cam said, well, let us know when your passport shows up, and we'll see if there is still that need. Because they wanted to get the project started as soon as possible. Well, about 2 weeks later, I was sitting in our house, and then Derek comes in with a mail, and he says, I think your passport came, Austin. And sure enough, here was a letter with my passport. My passport showed up 31 days after I had sent it in for renewal without being expedited. And I had prayed and asked God or told God, God, I'd like to go down to Haiti, but I have no passport. If you want me to go down there, please get my passport here ahead of what the plan was. And he did in an absolutely amazing way. So I never felt like that I was there, being there at the wrong place at the wrong time. I felt like God wanted me down in Haiti, if nothing else, just to teach me some things while being in the camp. So I flew down. Well, first I flew back to Ohio and was there for an international crisis conference for a couple days. And then I flew down to Haiti on Friday. I don't remember what date it was, but on Friday. And the next day, a group of 17 of us from the CAM base that went to visit an orphanage that was applying for help from CAM for, I think, maybe food, maybe some medicine, books, and so on. And a number of us went along just simply to enjoy being with the children, interacting with them. We were on our way back from that, driving on a major highway in Haiti, and driving along, I was sitting in the back of the van, wasn't really watching what was going on up front because I wasn't driving. Our driver was taking care of that. So all of a sudden, our driver just slammed on the brakes. Well, naturally, when someone slams on the brakes, you look up in front to see what's causing them to slam on the brakes. And up ahead of us, probably, I don't know, maybe 10th of a mile, give or take a little bit, there was a box truck and a pickup truck parked across the road lengthwise. And our driver immediately did a U-turn and headed back in the way we had been coming from. And the pickup truck came after us, pulled up beside us. There were guys in the back with guns. And then the pickup truck pulled in front of us and slammed on the brakes, forced us to stop. So we did. The guys hopped out of the back of the pickup and motioned for our driver to turn around and drive back to where that box truck was parked across the road. So we did. And then we were instructed to pull down a little side road there and just wait. So we pulled down the side road and waited. And I think we all in the vehicle knew what this was. No, I don't remember anybody said anything out loud, but we all knew this was a gang, and we all knew that they were, we didn't know what they were planning to do to us. I think a lot of people were hoping it was just they were going to rob us and then let us go, but nobody knew for sure. So while we're sitting there waiting, we started praying. I don't know if any of you have ever been in potential life-threatening situations, but they say there's no such thing as an atheist in a life-threatening situation. And we were praying out loud, praying in our minds, asking God to take care of us and protect us. And eventually, the truck that was in front of us started moving, so we followed. And we followed this truck back down this dirt road. We continued to pray. Some people in the group had some phones. They started sending out some messages for us, asking people to start praying for us. I tried to send a message to Dad on one of their phones, but for some reason it never went through. I'm still not quite sure why it didn't, but basically I just told him, I said, Dad, I didn't know what was going to happen. I said, we've been taken by bandits, I think is what I said. Get people praying. And so the ride back that dirt road was quite unique because after we had been driving for a little bit, our van started to get behind the truck that was in front of us. This was a typical Haitian dirt road, very bumpy. And so our driver was taking it slow across the bumps. And the two or three vehicles behind us that held gang members didn't appreciate that. Because at one point, three of them came running up beside the van, told us to stop, grabbed the door, yanked it open, and grabbed our driver and yanked him out of the vehicle. And one of them slapped him across the face, and then two of them grabbed him and took him off to one of the vehicles behind us. And then the third guy hopped in the driver's seat. And at that point, I'm pretty sure that we all in the van felt like we were never going to see our driver again. We thought they were taking him somewhere else. Thank you. And so the gangster who was driving proceeded to catch up with the truck that was in front of us, and so he mashed the pedal to the floor, and down the road we went bumping and I mean bumping. The best way to describe that drive was I probably spent more time with my hair plastered against the ceiling of the van than I did actually sitting on the seat. And so we drove for a little while back through this winding road, and eventually we ended up in a clearing where the two trucks parked and our vehicle parked beside them. And then the gangsters proceeded to go through these two trucks. We found out later had also kidnapped those two trucks and the drivers, and so they went through the trucks, I guess, to see what they had managed to collect there on the road. And then they came and circled the van that we were in. And it seemed like I don't remember exact number. There was probably 25 or 30 of them. And they all seemed to be either drunk or on drugs or both. And they all wanted, it seemed like, to open the sliding door of the van and look in at all of us. And we tried to smile and wave back at them. I mean, what do you do in a situation like that? But they all were extremely intrigued with the baby. There is even a gangster can't help but resist, I guess you could say, the smiles or whatever it was of a little baby. They all wanted to look at the little baby. So in the group, there were 17 people. There was Ryan and Melody Corver and their two children. There was a couple from Ohio, Matt and Rachel Miller. And then there was a mom and five of her children whose husband was still back at the base. And that mom's name was Cheryl, and then her five children were Sherilyn, Courtney, Brandon, Sonia, and Sheldon. Sheldon being 5 years old. The other ones were 14, 15, 18, and 27. Then there were three other single guys besides me. There was Sam Stoltzfus, Dale Weideman, and Wesley Yoder. And then there was a single VS worker who had been at the base for a year, year and a half, helping the moms there and so on. Kay Yoder was her name. So there were 17 of us total, and obviously Ryan and Melody's two children, Andre and Laura. Andre was 3, Laura was 8 months. So that was our group. I don't think I forgot anybody. And after the gangsters, it seemed like they were trying to decide what they wanted to do with us. And so they talked among themselves for a while. They talked with some of the people in the van that could speak Creole. They talked with them for a while. I couldn't understand what they were saying. But then eventually one of them, actually two of them, came to the back of the vehicle and opened the back doors of the vehicle. And this was a van with no trunk. So I was sitting in the very back, and I had about two or three gangsters standing right behind me talking in Creole, and I couldn't understand what they were saying. But they took a liking to the top of my head for whatever reason. One of them reached his hand in and started rubbing the top of my head like this. And the second guy reaches in and adds his hand to this other guy's hand. They're both rubbing the top of my head. And I wasn't sure what to do in that situation. Smile and wave, slap their hand away, ignore it, not quite sure what to do. And then they decided to do the same thing to my nose for whatever reason. I still haven't figured that one out. But it was pretty clear they were trying to decide, what are we going to do with these people? Well, eventually a decision was made. The Haitian driver hopped back in the vehicle and turned around and headed, I guess it would have been about northeast or something like that. And on the northern side of this clearing, there was a big high concrete wall or concrete fence. And our driver headed towards that fence at top speed. To the point, and we so fast and so close to it that we all thought he was just going to suicide crash into that wall. But he didn't. At the last minute, he turned right. And we had come in from the left. So I remember when he turned right, distinctly thinking, so it's not over yet. I had been hoping they would take us back to the road, but it wasn't over yet. So we drove for another minute or so, and eventually ended up at the first place that we were held captive. And it isn't quite perfect as far as the time frame goes, but for all practical purposes, we would just assume we were at each place about 3 weeks. We were at three different places, and we were at each about 3 weeks. It's not quite right, but it's close. So when we pulled in there, the first place we were at was a little compound with two buildings and a courtyard between the two buildings. And the courtyard between the two buildings had a structure that I assumed was built with the idea of being able to put like coconut leaves on it to act as a shade, because it was just sticks stuck in the ground and other sticks across from those posts and so on. And the thing is the Haitians, or these particular gangsters, apparently didn't know what nails and screws are, because those logs were tied together with strips of cloth. And I remember when we pulled up there, those strips of cloth hanging down from those tree trunks or whatever they were, my first thought was, well, they're just going to hang us all right here. That's honestly what it looked like. It looked like this was just a gigantic gallows for lots of people at a time. And so, well, it turns out they didn't hang us there. But they did open the van door, and that at this place they said they wanted all our phones and our money, and one guy threatened that he would kill us if we didn't give everything. If they found something on us later, they would shoot us all. That's what he said. And it was at this point that they brought Dale back. Up to this point, we had not seen Dale, who was driving. We had not seen him. We didn't know where he was at. Well, they brought him back and set him beside the van there, and once again talked among themselves for a little while, and then told us to get out of the van and to line up against the wall of one of the buildings. And one of the girls said later that she was sure they were just going to gun us all down right there. Because we had as we found out later, the second in command of the gang, and not the first in command or the overall commander, because the overall commander of that gang's in prison right now, but it was just a second in command, so kind of like the on-spot in command person. He was there. He was standing there. Well, there was a guy standing beside him taking a video of us, and we were singing a song. It was somewhat of a feeble attempt, but we were trying to sing a song, and the second in command was telling us to be quiet, and we kept singing. And then there was a guy beside him with a automatic assault rifle of some sort. And we did give nicknames to all the guards and gang members that we came in contact with, for the simple reason that way if we wanted to talk about them, we could, and they wouldn't understand us. They did not understand very much English. They could pick out certain words, and they could pick out their names. So if they heard their name, they knew we were talking about them. And by the way, the second in command that I'm referring to is the person that I believe the newspapers would have called Wilson Joseph, I think is who it was. That's who I'm referring to. Well, we nicknamed him Beanie. So if I ever say Beanie, I'm referring to the second in command, this Wilson Joseph guy. So after videoing us, they took us over to a door in one of the buildings and opened the door and instructed us all to go into that room. So we did. And this was a room that was probably, we estimated, about 10 by 12. Not a very big room. And we walked in the door, and there were two mattresses inside there. And the rest of the floor was covered with cardboard, and we were instructed to sit down, so we did. We sat down, some on the mattresses, some on the floor. And they closed the door and barred it. And then for the rest of the day, they kept on bringing us stuff. The first thing they brought was another mattress, so now we had three mattresses, two singles and one double. And after they brought that mattress, the door opens and a guard brings in a bag full of food, which none of us were hungry at that present moment. I mean, we kind of all had lost our appetites. And so we took it and thanked him and set it in the middle of the room, and we never ate a single bite of that. At least I didn't. I think Andre had a little bit, but he was the only one that ate any. And then eventually Beanie opens the door and comes in with a cell phone. He wanted us to contact our boss, as he said, which would have been the CAM director at that time, whose name is Barry Grant. Not Barry Grant. I think it's Barry Grant. And so Ryan or Sam, I don't remember which one it was, made the phone call to Barry, and Barry answered, and Sam talked with him a little, or whoever it was, talked with him a little bit. He asked where we were, and we said we didn't know, but we said we were all together and we're all okay at the moment. And about that time, Beanie grabs the phone and starts talking to Barry in Creole, so I couldn't understand what he was saying. But as Sam interpreted later, basically he told Barry that he wanted $1 million apiece per person for a total of $17 million, and Barry proceeded to start preaching at him. And the phone conversation ended shortly after that. And then Beanie left. But when he left, he apparently took notice of the fact that none of us had eaten any of the food. Because about a half hour to an hour later, the door opens, and in comes another Haitian. We hadn't seen him. He hadn't been on the road or anything like that. We were kidnapped, but this guy spoke very, very fluent English. But he wasn't a native Haitian. He wasn't a Native American, or I should say he wasn't native to the U.S., because he definitely had a Haitian accent. But he said that he had either lived in Miami for a time or grown up in Miami. And his main job was to come in and see why we weren't eating. And we explained to him that none of us really had an appetite because of what had happened. And he tried very much to assure us that this gang was not out to hurt us, so you don't have to worry. Well, that was a little consolation, but not a whole lot. And he said, I mean, what do you want to eat? I mean, do you want hamburgers or pizza? He said, I could maybe get that for you if you wanted. And we said, no, we like rice and beans, but we're just not hungry. But he still couldn't seem to get that through his head. Because when he left, he told us that he was going to bring us back some American food. So the first day was quite unique. So we were kidnapped. We were stuck in that room about 1:30, give or take a little bit. And what did we do that first day? Well, we pretty much just sat around, and we did pray some. We did sing a little bit. But there was also just the long periods of silence where people were just kind of thinking probably their own thoughts. And I know I was definitely thinking thoughts. There were lots of thoughts going through my mind, wondering if I was going to survive the day, wondering what my family would do when they heard the news. And I remember thinking about wondering, am I going to make it back in time for my sister's wedding? And so people sometimes ask the question of, were you scared? For me personally, I think it was the first couple days, yes, I was a little bit scared. I didn't know what they were planning on doing. But it was probably about the second day or third day that we had been in captivity that the guards brought two couches for us. And I remember when the day they brought those couches, I kind of lost my fear and realized that they probably weren't out to hurt us. Because when you bring two full-size couches on the back of a motorbike plus three people on the same motorbike, you're pretty dedicated to be able to get that there. And I figured they probably weren't out to hurt us if they were going to that much trouble to bring us mattresses. Or not mattresses, bringing us couches. But this first day, no one knew what they were out to do. No one knew how long we were going to be there. One thing that we did do that first day when he came in and wanted us to call Barry is we memorized his number so that we would have Barry's number in case we needed it later. Oh, and by the way, this other guy that came into the room, we nicknamed him Santa Claus because he kept bringing us food and snacks and so on throughout the time we were there. So as nighttime came on, we started to realize that we were possibly going to have to spend the night in this 8x12 room with 17 people, 3 mattresses, 2 single and a double for 17 people. And so we started trying to figure out exactly, so how are we going to do this? Well, there were 2 couples, and so we decided that they would sleep in the center of the room and kind of be the buffer between the single ladies and the single guys, because we were all going to be in the same room that night. And there wasn't actually enough room for everybody to lay down at the same time, so I started the night out in a chair beside the door. And so that night was a long night. But it seemed like the guards came and checked on us about every hour, give or take a little bit. And they never quite seemed to get the concept that when you're checking on people who are sleeping, it's helpful to lower the tone of your voice and not to shine your flashlight in everybody's eyes while you count to make sure we're all there. Because they would wake us up about every hour. They would come around and bellow into the room and wake the children up, and the children would start crying. And it was hot in there. There was one door, no windows, very little air movement. And so the children already had trouble going to sleep because of the heat, and the guards would make it worse by waking them up about every hour. Eventually, one of the guys asked me if I wanted to trade places so I could get some sleep. And so I said, sure, that would be great. So he got up, and you had to move quickly in a situation like that, because with 17 people in that size of a room, when one person stood up, it was kind of like the waves of the ocean. Just everybody just kind of filled in the spot where he had been. So he got up, and I dove into the spot where he was, and I managed to get down and get completely stretched out, and I fell asleep pretty quickly. And then when I woke up a couple hours later and wanted to swap back with him so he could get some more sleep, I had to pull my feet out from under a pile of about 5 or 6 or 7 feet that were on top of mine. So it was tight. And another description, or another picture of how tight it was one at one point in the middle of the night, one of the girls looked across the room, and she said that there were 4 guys laying on their backs with their legs sticking straight up the wall, because there was no other spot to put your feet. So it was quite tight. We had to spend 2 nights in that room in those kind of conditions. The second night that we were there, about halfway through the night, the guards took pity on Ryan and Melody and their children and let them outside, took one of the mattresses outside and let them sleep outside on that mattress. And then after that night, they brought us a 4th mattress, so we now had 2 double mattresses and 2 singles. And then after that night, they let Ryan and Melody and their children outside. They would let one of the mattresses outside for the night, and they would let however many people could fit on the mattress or would just sleep on the ground beside the mattress outside. So there was generally 4, 5, 6, 7 people sleeping outside while the rest were inside. So that made it to the point where the people inside could actually have enough space to sleep. It was still tight, but you could generally get sleep throughout the night. And the second night when we were sleeping there, trying to sleep, it's hot and we're all sweating and the children are fussing again, and then the door opens and one of the guards comes in with a battery-powered fan and sets the fan there and turns it on oscillating so it's blowing on all of us and turns it on high, and out the door he goes. And a battery-powered fan, these battery-powered fans on high lasted for about 1.5 hours. So we decided that we were going to turn it down so the battery would last longer, so we turned it down. Well, the next time the guards came in to check on us, they turned it back up to full again. And within 1.5 hours, that fan was dead. And the next time the guards checked on us, they saw it was dead, so they pulled that fan out and brought another one in and proceeded to do the same thing. And that was their last fan. And after 1.5 hours, we were out of fans for the night. But that was kind of how they seemed to approach just about everything, because eventually they brought us 2 box fans and a generator to run the fans at night and wired up this generator so the fans could be turned on at night. But they didn't seem to understand the concept of You know, it's nice to have an extra container of gas for the generator, so when it runs out, you pour it in and then go look for more gas. Their concept was you run the generator until it's out of gas, and then you go look for more gas. So there might be a day or so where you didn't have any fans because there was no gas for the generator. And while we were there in Haiti, there was a nationwide gas storage to the point where there were some times where they couldn't get gas for the generator, and so we would go a couple days without fans. And that might not seem like a huge deal, but when that's your only source of air movement in the whole room, it's very, very, very nice. So that building we were in had three rooms and a porch on it, and as we found out later, there were 11 other people in the other room, which that room was slightly larger than our room, but not much. There were 11 other people in that room, people the gang had also kidnapped. There were Haitians, Dominican Republic's people, and one Korean and one Chinese guy in that room that were being held captive. And the people sometimes wonder how the guards treated us. As far as that goes, the guards treated us fairly nicely. Those men in that other room were tied hand and foot the entire time. The only time they were let loose was they had to go take a shower or go to the bathroom. Otherwise, they were tied hand and foot. We were never tied. We were threatened with being tied up a couple times if we wouldn't listen and do what the guards said, but they never actually did it. So probably about the third or fourth day we were there, Santa Claus showed up. True to his word, with some American food, he brought a couple huge boxes of American-made snack food, including Doritos, Pringles, sardines, aloe vera drink, and a number of other things that were American-made food, and gave it to us. And we tried to, that time, we tried to ask him, you know, what's this gang after? Because, I mean, they said they wanted money, and was that all they were after? We tried to talk to him, and I don't remember that he said a whole lot that second time, but the third time he came, he did give us some more information the third time, and he claimed this gang was not trying to get money for us. That was his claim. He claimed that this gang was trying to use us as leverage to get their leader out of prison, who was in prison with a life sentence. That was what they were trying to do. And he said they're not out to kill you, they're not out to make money off of you, they're just trying to get their leader free from prison. He told us that Beanie had a $15 million bounty on his head. So as far as the group goes, there were three people in our group that could talk Creole good enough to communicate. Those three people were Sam, Wes, and Kay. They could all talk it enough that they could understand, and so they also kind of fell into the role of being our primary preachers, with Sam probably doing the brunt of it, because he is more of an outspoken person than Wes is, and so he wasn't afraid to preach to these gangsters. And I believe that any new guard or gangster that showed up had the gospel preached to them in no uncertain terms through Sam. And even Beanie did. That day that the third time Santa Claus was there and told us that this gang wasn't out to make money from us, we weren't quite sure if we believed that. Because it was just shortly after that that Sam told Beanie that he wanted to see Beanie in heaven, so Beanie needs to repent. And Beanie said, well, if you give me $13 million, I'll see you in heaven. And Sam said, no, that's not quite how it works. So that's what Beanie was saying, and then Santa Claus was trying to tell us that these guys wanted their leader free and they weren't out to get money. We weren't quite sure exactly still what they were trying to get. Now, as far as my role being down there, I remember very distinctly wondering, what am I supposed to do down here? I can't speak Creole. I can't preach to these guys. I would have loved to, but I couldn't. And so I remember one time I was thinking about it, one time I was praying about it, and I felt God telling me, Austin, you can't preach to these guys, but you can encourage the rest of the people in your group. If there's somebody in your group that's feeling down or discouraged or that needs help, you be the one to step up and help them and encourage them. So that's what I attempted to do. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. Because people ask the question, so were you ever discouraged? Were you ever scared? Were you, you know, what kind of feelings, you know, yeah, basically, what were you ever discouraged or down in the dumps or anything like that? And I think I can honestly say that there was only two or three days out of the 62 days where I was actually feeling discouraged. Two of those days was 2 days that I was sick, when I came down with a really bad case of food poisoning and was laying on my back for 2 whole days in that one room, staring at a very ugly ceiling, trying to figure out why I was sick. And the other time was the day of my sister's wedding that I did end up missing. But as far as that goes, those were about the only days that I remember being really, really, really discouraged. The other people in our group were, for the most part, stayed fairly upbeat and positive, but there were some days where people were a little bit down in the dumps. I remember one morning in particular, we were there, and I was still inside the house. I hadn't got up yet, but the 15-year-old boy that was down there had went up and had got up and went outside and looked to see where everybody was, and he came back in. He told me, he said, it's the attitude out there, he said, is phenomenal. He said, everybody's kind of sitting off in their own world with nobody smiling, and Sam's over there writing a last will and testament to his family. And I remember that morning very distinctly wondering, God, so how am I going to encourage everybody today? And I don't remember exactly what happened that day, but it did, I think if I remember right, that did end up being a good day. But as is normal in groups of people, we did disagree on certain things. With 17 people, you did disagree. But one thing that I found very interesting about being in such close quarters with 17 people for so long is if you disagreed with somebody, you couldn't get away from them. You really had to learn how to continue to appreciate them as individuals. And I believe that's what God wants us to do in the church. In the church, you actually can get away from people to a certain extent. You only see them on Sunday, maybe Wednesday evening as well, but otherwise you can get away from them. Down there you couldn't. And so if you didn't agree with somebody on something, you had to figure out how to agree to disagree and still appreciate them as a person. And well, I'll just say here that the one of the main things that we disagreed on was whether we should try and escape or not, whether that was something God wanted us to do. And I'll get to, there's more on that later, but that was something that we definitely did differ on. And it did lead to some rather interesting situations. But one thing we did see quite a bit was we saw a lot of answered prayer down there. It was actually amazing to see all the prayers God answered. First of all, the first situation we had where God answered a prayer, well, obviously He kept us safe. He kept us all together. That was a couple prayers that we prayed. And by the way, I thank you for your prayers. For those of you that prayed for us, I'm sure you did. And we definitely appreciated the prayers. We felt the prayers and we needed the prayers. And they did make a difference. So thank you for praying. Prayer is powerful and it does make a difference. But one day, Cheryl, the mom, the 40-year-old mom that was there with her 5 children woke up and she was sick. And she told me that she suspected she had an infection somewhere in her body. It was somewhere in her gut region that basically did not allow her to find a comfortable position. She couldn't lie down, she couldn't stand, she couldn't sit without it hurting. And we had nothing as far as medicines go, nothing. And so eventually that day we ended up praying for her. We gathered around her, we laid our hands on her, we prayed for her. And the next morning, she was back to full strength. She was 100% healed. She was still a little bit weak, but whatever infection had been bothering her that earlier in the day was gone. Just completely healed the next day. So God answered our prayer in a very real way there. The interesting thing is like just that night, the night after we prayed, before she went to bed, Beanie had showed up. And we had told him that she needed medicine because she was not feeling well. So he had left saying he would see what he could do. Well, by the time he got back with the medicine, God had already healed her. But he didn't end up coming back with the medicine until about a week and a half later. Or maybe even longer. And another thing we had, so Matt, the couple there in our group, Matt was also someone that dealt with a physical ailment, something that he had had ever since he was a child, and I don't know the medical name, but basically what it is it makes so his immune system works at about 5 times the rate that your immune system works. And so he's constantly tired and out of energy. And so he had to take a medicine every day and a shot once a week that to suppress his immune system down to what a person's immune system would normally be like. And he didn't have any of that. That was all back at the base. So we told Beanie numerous times that he needed medicine, Matt did. Because it would make his fingers, like his knuckles, swell up really bad and crack and quite painful at times. And Beanie would, you know, ask what kind of medicine, and they would talk, and it was prescription-only medicine. But Beanie did say he would see what he could do. Matt gave him the name of it one evening, and Beanie said he'd see what he could do, but Matt wasn't sure what he could do because prescription-only medicine only made in the U.S., And so we were at this first place for about 3 weeks, 2.5 to 3 weeks. And shortly before we were moved the first time, we got a chance to call Barry one more time. And it was a short conversation. We only had about a 30-second conversation there. But in that phone conversation, Barry told us, he said, the whole world's praying for you. And that meant a lot. That meant a lot to know the whole world was praying for us. And we didn't know exactly how real that was until after we got out. But Cam set up an email where people from across the world could send in emails with prayers and notes of encouragement to the families of the people that were kidnapped. And as I found out later, there were notes and prayers that came in from over 52 countries in the world. So people across the world were truly praying for us. Taking a shower was quite interesting. The shower house consisted of a room on the side of the building that was surrounded by curtains that may or may not be full of holes. And what you had to do if you wanted to take a shower was you took a bucket of water and a metal scoop and went in there, would scoop water out of the bucket, dump it over your head, take the soap, lather up on the soap, and then proceed to rinse yourself off by dumping more water over your head. In the meantime, the clothes that you were wearing would probably be outside. Someone would be washing them, and when you were done, they would hand them back over the wall wet, and you'd put them back on, and they would dry throughout the course of the day. And they did eventually bring a bag full of clothes that was supposed to be enough for each of us to have a second pair of clothes. Well, we didn't find any cape dresses in that bag. So the ladies ended up wearing their clothes for every day for 60 days straight. And the guys did find enough assortment of pants and shirts that we could generally, when we took a shower, you could wash your jeans and then hang them up on the line. And let them dry throughout the course of the day, and then by the time you put them back on to sleep in, they would generally be dry. But I definitely did feel sorry for the ladies to have to wear the same dress for 60 days straight. And let's see, what else here? Okay, so just a little bit about the order of the day. Our days were pretty similar. You got up in the morning anywhere, probably about 7 or 8 o'clock is when you'd get up, and breakfast would come anywhere from 9 to 2. And then we would always have a time of singing and prayer in the morning when we got up, after we got up. And then we would also pray about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. We wouldn't sing very often at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, but we would always pray. And then we would often sing and pray again before we went to bed. For sure we would pray, and we often would sing as well. And the 1 o'clock prayer we eventually designated as at 1 o'clock we would go around the circle and we would pray, focusing almost exclusively on asking God to deliver us. Whereas the morning and evening was more, you just pray whatever you prayed for, whatever God laid on your heart. That was pretty much our day. In between the times of praying and singing, You would take a shower if you wanted to, wash clothes if you wanted to, and after that, it was pretty much if you wanted something to do, you had to find somebody to talk to. And that was pretty much all there was to do. No books, no cell phones, no games of any sort. And so you had to learn how to entertain yourself with other people, which was, it was actually quite, I enjoyed that. The fact of getting to know people without any kind of technology trying to get in the way. As far as the food that they served us, supper then would come anytime from between 4 and 8, or 3:30 and 8 o'clock in the evening. We had two meals a day. They never quite seemed to bring enough food for 17 people to the point where you got done eating and you felt full. They brought enough that you wouldn't starve to death, but you would lose weight. I think I lost a total of 20 pounds. And the four single guys, me and the other three guys that were there, collectively lost over 100 pounds. The food was, for breakfast, most common was spaghetti, cooked in fish oil. That was most common. And occasionally, three or four times, he brought eggs and scrambled eggs and bread and avocados. Supper was almost always rice and or beans of some sort with a sauce to put over the rice and beans. Sometimes it was just white rice, other times it was white rice and beans. Two or three times we had a bean sauce with like dumplings inside that was, you ate kind of like a soup. And then, but the rice and beans always had a sauce to put over it, and that sauce was either fish sauce, or there were, sometimes they would bring cooked vegetables, and once or twice they brought chicken sauce. Which, if you didn't like fish, you were a little bit in trouble, because fish was about in everything. And I remember I felt sorry for Sam. I like fish personally. I like the taste of fish, so it was no big deal for me to eat fishy spaghetti. But I felt sorry for Sam because he did not like fish, and so he had to eat it. So the guards, their attitudes toward us was quite interesting. At first they were very cautious, very, very vigilant in keeping an eye on us. At this first place we were at, there was always one guard watching us throughout the whole day. They would let us outside. After the second night we were there, they would let us outside through the day, in the day, but there was always somebody watching us. And they would also try to be helpful. I think they tried to be helpful. But sometimes their helpfulness almost came across as being irritating because they seemed like they had this impression that we as white people didn't know how to do anything for ourselves, and thus they needed to do everything for us. And so sometimes it was a little bit irritating when they would try and do something for you that you could easily do yourself. But they definitely did try to intimidate us with the guns they had. As we found out later, the guards that were there throughout the course of the day, they had three guns with them. They had a pistol, they had a shotgun with a bent barrel, and they had an older style assault rifle. Those were their three guns that they had. But they tried to intimidate us with the guns. If we did something they didn't like, they would march angrily up to the person that did it and stand in front of them and yell and shout and, you know, threateningly cock their guns in front and expect us to cower, I guess, and we never did. And it seemed to irritate them to a certain extent. And I remember numerous times Sam, you know, they would threaten that, you know, they're like, well, don't you know we could shoot you? And Sam would tell them, well, yeah, you can, but we'll just go to heaven. And that kind of seemed to take the wind out of their intimidation sails. But they did love the children. They absolutely loved the children. And, you know, we would let them talk to the children. Ryan and Melody didn't want them to hold the children, so we tried to keep them from being able to hold the children. But one thing they really, 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 really enjoyed to do was fist bump the children. And I didn't realize this when I first went down there. But I'm going to ask a question. Does anybody know where fist bumping originated? Anybody want to take a guess at it? Fist bumping originated in U.S. gangs, was where fist bumping started. And I'm not saying that to say that if you want to fist bump somebody, that is totally your call. But I didn't realize that when I went down there. And their fist bumping, that seemed like it was more than just a gesture of friendship. They wanted to fist bump the children, so they would fist bump the children, and then they would always tap their heart twice with their fist. And later on, we wondered if maybe there was something evil in that gesture. Because one night, Andre, the little 3-year-old boy, was insisting to his mom and dad that the person who brought us our food and water, a man by the name of Mackinson, that's what he told us his name was, Andre insisted over and over that Mackinson was a good man because he brought us food and water and, you know, stuff we needed. And Ryan and Melody kept telling him, no, he's not a good man because he's living in sin. He's not living according to the Bible. He's not a good man. Andre was insisting that he was. And we weren't sure at the time, but we did wonder. A couple things that happened later made us fairly certain that this Mackinson was some kind of a witch doctor of some sort in that area. And so, as Ryan said one morning, he asked us to pray for Andre because he said it felt like the spirit of Mackinson was in Andre to a certain extent. So we did. We prayed. And Ryan and Melody told Andre, you are not allowed to fist bump the guards anymore. If he did, he got a spanking. And the interesting thing is it took a couple times, but Andre did learn that he wasn't supposed to do that. And I found it very interesting to watch. Eventually, Andre got to the point where when one of the guards would want to fist bump him, he would look at them just with a stone, expressionless face, just look at them, and then very slowly and deliberately turn around and walk back to Ryan or Melody, wherever they were. So that was something, another answer to prayer in a way. Eventually, we did get moved to a second location, and basically what happened there is one night we were having our time of singing in prayer, and Mackinson drove in with a couple other guards, and he told Sam that we were leaving. They were moving us to a different spot. So they proceeded to load up everything, generator, mattresses, fans, food, whatever they could find, loaded up in the back of the pickup and headed off with it somewhere. We timed them, and it was about 45 minutes till they came back for us. But in the meantime, we had been singing and praying, standing in a group, standing around a circle, singing and praying, arms around each other, holding hands, whatever the case might be. And I remember that one afternoon, Cheryl, the mom, whose family had lived in Kenya for 7 years as a missionary, she told me that one afternoon that God had given her a vision of an angel coming to that camp where we were at and taking all of us out through the bushes. This camp was surrounded by bushes on all four sides. There were 3 ways in, 2 footpaths and the road. And this angel had come and taken us right out through one of the thickest bushes. She said parted it like the Red Sea. And I remember that night we were praying. And I remember thinking, God, this is a perfect night to send your angel and take us out. Because I was certain that God didn't want us to move to the second location. Well, turns out he did, because we got moved. The second location was a nicer spot to be at, as far as there was more room. The house that we slept in had 4 rooms instead of 2, and we were allowed to have all 4 of them, although one was used as a shower. And it had a roof on it this time, which was nice. Oh, and by the way, it wasn't a shower when we got there, but the chief of the guards, who was in charge of the ones got people watching over us, decided to make it into a shower room. So he took a broken wrench and pounded a hole through a concrete wall with a broken wrench to make us a shower spot, so we could take a shower and then sweep the water out the hole with a broken wrench. Another difference from this place, the second place, from the first place, was it wasn't surrounded by bushes, it was surrounded by farming fields. And so the whole thing of the idea of escaping was something that we started talking about at the second spot and kind of started taking root that maybe this is something we should do, and it would have been easier at that second spot, but you would have needed probably about a 10 or 15 minute head start to get out of sight from the guards because it was surrounded by fields. And so some things that happened at this spot were one night, I think it was the night we moved or the night after, Beanie shows up with a big box of medicine. And when I say medicine, the gangsters kind of did things all in, you know, kind of gung-ho and everything they did. Because in this box were 6 boxes of Benadryl and something kind of like Tylenol or Advil or ibuprofen or something like that. And included in that box was also a bottle of U.S.-made prescription medicine for Matt. It wasn't quite the kind that we had asked for, but it was prescription medicine made in the U.S. And we kind of wondered how the gangsters got their hands on that. Dan, you might wonder, did it help Matt? It didn't help per se, but it did keep it from getting worse. I don't think it made it better as far as his condition goes, but it kind of kept it at the spot it was at that time. And at that time, he had been without his medicine for about three weeks or something like that, and he definitely was feeling it. And I know we prayed for him and his wife quite a bit. Let's see, next thing. Oh, yes. I should give the nicknames for the guards because I will start using their nicknames at some point. As far as the number of guards we had at the first spot, it was probably about six or so that were there in the daytime, and then at night there would be anywhere from 12 to 15 there. So I'm not sure the night guards, we didn't see them during the day, and we didn't necessarily have a chance to give them nicknames. But our day guards, we did give them nicknames. The chief of the guards that I already referred to, we nicknamed him Ping. The reason for that is, I don't know if any of you have read the book about Ping the Yellow Duck. So Ping the Yellow Duck's owner had that hairdo of three pigtails sticking up from various spots on his head. Well, one day, Ping came around with a very similar hairdo, so he was nicknamed Ping. And he told us that he claimed he was in his high 30s as far as age goes. Like 36, I think is what he said, but he honestly looked like he could have been 65. And ironically enough, his real name was Emmanuel, which means God with us. Just an interesting detail. Then also at that place, we had a guard we nicknamed Charlie Horse. His nickname was given to him because if you know of a circus that needs a lead clown, he would fit that role tremendously well. There was the one we nicknamed Hashtag Earmuffs because he had a t-shirt that he liked to wear that had that across the front. Then there was an Archie and a Henry and a Carrot Top. Carrot Top was a Haitian with orange hair. And when we moved to this second spot, Carrot Top and Charlie Horse went with us, and Ping went with us, and then three new guards showed up when we were at that spot. We nicknamed them, the first one we nicknamed Rookie, because he told us he had been with the gang for about a month, and so he was still kind of learning the ropes of things. And then there was another one that we nicknamed Zigzag. And I don't remember why we nicknamed him Zigzag. But Zigzag was a unique individual. And the reason I say unique is because and I still think about Zigzag some. He told us his real name was Patrick. But if God would ever get a hold of his life and turn his life around, he would be the kind of person who would be willing to do anything for anyone at any time, no matter what. That's what he did to us. If you wanted something, whether it was, you know, fresh coconuts or fresh mangoes or something like that, and you would ask him for it, he would do his absolute best to get it for you. He might not be successful, but he would try. And remember, he's supposed to be guarding us as prisoners, but he would try and do whatever we would ask him to do. And then there was a third guy that we nicknamed Attitude for the simple fact that he had quite a large attitude. So it was while we were at this second spot that the gas shortage happened, and they weren't always able to run the generator. And so one day they showed up with a ginormous solar panel. And when I say ginormous, I mean it was probably about a 6-foot by 12-foot solar panel. And they set it up on one of the roofs of the house and wired it up to four car batteries. And then they would run the fans at night off of those batteries. They would charge them during the day and run the fans at night. And those batteries would generally run those box fans and the other battery-powered fans that they brought along. Would run them until about 2 o'clock in the morning on a full charge. And by that time in the morning, it was often cool enough you didn't necessarily need the fans. They were nice for noise cancellation because the guards may or may not be outside all night playing music on the porch or shooting their guns at random times throughout the course of the night. And so that was nice just simply for blocking out some of that noise. But there was also some times where that solar panel would malfunction. And when it malfunctioned, it wouldn't charge anything throughout the course of the day. And so I remember one day in particular, we were getting ready to go to bed, and Ping informed Sam that there was no power in those batteries. The solar panel had not worked at all. And it was really, really hot that night when we went into the house, stifling, in fact. And for me personally, there's two of my pet peeves when it comes to trying to sleep are, I like my room really cold, and I like a little bit of noise just to block out other kinds of noise. And this night I knew that both of these were not going to be a reality. It was going to be the opposite. And I knew it was going to be a potentially a long night. So our sleeping arrangement at that point, at that spot, we had two rooms we were sleeping, actually three rooms we were sleeping in. In the one room we had pretty much all the ladies, and Matt and Rachel also slept in that room. But then in the room that was in front of that room that you had to go through to get to that back room was where the single guys would sleep. And then Ryan and Melody and their family would sleep in the third room. And so at that night when we went to bed, I was sleeping kind of in the doorway between the room where the guys were sleeping and the girls were sleeping. I was using the threshold between the door as a pillow, which, by the way, a concrete threshold works for a pillow if you need to use that. And so I'm laying there, and it is hot, very hot, and it just kind of got worse. It didn't get any better, and eventually it got to the point where I was just fed up with what was going on. So I decided that I was going to take some time to talk to God and complain. And I had a list of complaints to give to God. So I rolled over on my stomach and prepared to give those complaints. But before I started, I looked into the room where the girls were sleeping. And one of the girls who was sleeping right inside the door, on the other side of the door, was sitting up against the wall. And I assume she was praying or had been praying. And so before I started my list of complaints, I asked her, I said, are you all melting in there yet? Because I knew that room was warmer than the room I was in. It was always about 2 or 3 degrees warmer in that room than where I was. And I was already warm. And her answer to that really, really, really shocked me. Or kind of took me off guard. She answered and she told me, she said, I'm just pretending that we're in God's refining fire, which was a very, very apt description considering where we were at and the temperature. And so it kind of caught me off guard and made me think. And so I did end up praying that night. But the interesting thing is when I opened my mouth to pray, I couldn't have complained if I'd have wanted to. All that would come out was just thanking and praising God for what he had done. And another thing that, well, since I was up and she was up, we ended up talking for a while that night just to keep us kind of, because neither one of us could sleep. But she also told me that night that one thing she had done, or one thing she had been able to do, was she had been able to pray to God. She had been able to surrender her right to be free. And that might sound a little bit like a unique, might sound a little unique, but the Bible does tell us that we're God's servants. Now, he views us as children. He views us as joint heirs with Jesus. But at the same time, we are his servants. And so we don't have a right to be free. But we do have a right to be, we do have a right to know that he's with us all the time. And so I thought about that for quite a while that night. I did eventually end up going to sleep about 4 o'clock in the morning. So I thought about that till about 4 o'clock in the morning. Or maybe even a little bit later. And by the end of the night, I was able to pray that same prayer to God and just say, God, it's up to you when we get out. I'm going to look to you to get us out in your way and in your time. And one thing that we prayed quite a bit in our praying for deliverance was we prayed that God would deliver us in a way that would show his power, show his glory to the world, to the gang, and to us. Another thing that happened at this location was we had a plane start circling up over top of us. One day at 1 o'clock we were praying, and where I was standing there waiting for my turn to pray, and I heard a plane go overhead, which wasn't a huge, I didn't think a lot about, because both spots we were held captive at were probably within a mile of the flight path for any passenger jet going into the Port-au-Prince Airport. And so there were, a couple times a day you'd have these big old pasture jets flying within, probably a mile of our camp. So I didn't think about it a whole lot. But as I listened, I realized that this plane was right up above us and it was circling because it kept, you could hear it go fade and then it would come back. And I looked up and I started looking for it. And pretty soon I saw it. A little white plane up there was doing a figure eight above us. And we were somewhere in the middle of that figure eight. So when we got done praying, I pointed it out to everybody and we observed it for a while. And throughout the time that we were there, we saw four different planes circling us. And from that day to the day that God delivered us out of there, every day there was a plane circling above us for anywhere up to 6 hours out of the day. And we decided to nickname these planes as well because the guards did understand the word plane. They also understood the word helicopter. They understood certain words. So this little plane that we first saw, we nicknamed our DLP for our dear little plane. And then there was a medium-sized plane. I don't remember we gave a nickname to that one so much, but then eventually we saw another plane, this humongous. And when I say humongous, it was a humongous plane that would circle us. Like a four-engine turboprop plane would circle us. And we nicknamed that the BFG for Big Friendly Giant. But we didn't know who those planes were. And I remember the first day we saw them, we thought maybe this was an indication that maybe somebody had found us and knew we were there and at some point soon we would be out of there. And so that was our hope. But throughout the course of the next 5 or 6 weeks, a plane would just circle us every day. There was one other gang member that I forgot to give his nickname. This was probably the third in command of the gang. He had less authority than Beanie, but more authority than any other person in the gang that we saw. And we nicknamed him Papa Wheelie Chief. That was his nickname. And the reason for that was he always came in a motorcycle, and he always insisted upon popping a wheelie for us before he left. He was so excited to do that. That one time he almost took his head off on our clothesline trying to pop a wheelie for us. So we nicknamed him that. And one day when we were at the second spot, he showed up. And one thing we prayed quite a bit when we were down there is we prayed that God would just would utterly confuse and confound the work of this gang. That whatever they would try and do would just not work. That God would put roadblocks in their way, that he would show them who he was, show them his angels, whatever the case might be. And this day when Papa Wheelie Chief showed up, he had a wound on his shoulder. It looked very, very painful. It was a big, long wound on his shoulder. And he told Sam that he had been in a motorcycle accident the day before. And I remember distinctly thinking, was that an accident or was that God? Was that an accident or was that God answering our prayer? And another reason I wondered that is because Sam asked Papa Wheelie Chief that day and said, when are we leaving? And Papa Wheelie Chief said, well, if it was up to me, you'd be gone already, but it's not up to me. So two stories now that illustrate a little bit the spiritual battle that we were in. So none of us down there in Haiti were being held captive because we were Christians. That was not really the point or the reason why we were kidnapped. But at the same time, we were in the middle of a territory where Satan was the master. And we definitely experienced times of spiritual warfare. And these next two stories illustrate that, but also at the same time illustrate God's power over Satan's power. So one morning, Sam had got up a little bit earlier than he normally did. He was outside the house praying, and he was standing beside a tree. And Mackinson came walking over to where Sam was standing. And he didn't say anything to Sam, but he reached down, and beside the tree, there was a black bag with some bottle of something inside the black bag. And he reached down, he screwed the lid onto whatever the bottle was down there. And Sam watched him. And then when he was done, he noticed Sam watching him. So he said to Sam, he said, this right here is Satan's stuff. He said, don't touch it or it'll bite you. That was his comment. So Sam came over to where the rest of us who were up at that time were, and he told us what had happened, and he asked me, what would you do to that bottle? And I said, I think I would pick it up and throw it out in the field as far as I can. And he said, let's go do that. And so four of us went over there, We picked the bottle up. We prayed over it. We didn't know what it was, but we figured it had something to do with their satanic power or satanic worship. So we prayed against the power in that bottle and prayed that Jesus' power would defeat whatever power was in there, and then took the bottle and threw it out in the field as far as we could. So we knew, at least I knew, that night there was going to be some kind of a confrontation, because they would come back and reopen that bottle about dusk. So that was going to happen at some point that evening. I didn't know what was going to happen. Maybe a little bit of apprehension there. But what did end up happening was just God doing some amazing work to keep us safe. So that night we were having our time of prayer when we saw Mackinson coming. And Mackinson just walked right past us where we were praying and walked right over to that tree where the bottle was supposed to be. And pretty soon I looked over there and he's shining his flashlight around on the ground. He called some of the other guards over there and they're shining around looking for something. I knew what they were looking for. I knew where it was roughly. And pretty soon Mackinson put two and two together apparently of what had happened. And some of you might wonder what was in the bottle. I'm not sure what was in the bottle. I didn't see this, but one of the guys said when it hit the ground, the lid popped off and some kind of red liquid was coming out of the bottle. But I didn't actually see that myself. So Mackinson came over to where we were praying and wanted to talk to Sam. Sam was kind of, he was the one that spoke Creole the best, and the gangsters kind of assumed he was our chief. And so anything we did that made them upset, he was the one that got blamed for it, whether he had done it or not. He technically wasn't the one who had actually thrown the bottle into the field, but he was the one Mackinson blamed for doing it. So he came over and started yelling at Sam, but when he started coming over, we started singing. And we decided to sing, and we sang. And as soon as one song was done, somebody would start another song after a couple seconds. We probably sang for about a half hour. And Mackinson just sat and listened to us the whole half hour. And then eventually Sam said, "Let's go inside." So we stopped singing, and we got everything we would need for the night, and we started walking over towards the door to the house. And Mackinson walked over and stood in front of the door with his arms crossed. Just stood there. And pretty soon, he starts yelling at Sam. And Sam starts yelling back. I mean, when I say yelling, I mean, I don't think Sam was angry at Mackinson, but he was, he rebuked him in the name of Jesus a couple times, and Mackinson was shouting at him, and Ping came over and joined in the shouting match, and he told Sam, he cocked his pistol and told Sam, "Don't you know I could shoot you?" And Sam said, "Yeah, you can, but I'll just go to prison. I'm not prison, I'll go to heaven." And they're yelling and shouting at Sam, and the rest of us. And so Mackinson did step away from the door, so the ladies were able to go inside. But most of the guys were still outside at that point. And we're praying. And it was this night where Melody said that she saw an angel. That she saw an angel flying around our group for about two and a half minutes. She said she saw it. I was hoping the whole time we were down there that God would give me the privilege of seeing one of his angels, but I never did. Never saw one. But Melody said she saw one, and Brandon, the 15-year-old boy, thought he saw one time, and Wes also thought he saw one as well. At one point, different times, but at one point. But this night, Melody was certain that she saw an angel just flying around our group. And it was interesting because to me, I was just sure that Maxon was going to take a swing at Sam at one point. That was how angry he was. And whenever he would take a step towards Sam, Ryan and Brandon, I think, would step up beside Sam and just put their arms around him. They wouldn't say anything, they just step up beside him. And each time they would do that, Mackinson would stop. There is definitely a power in being together. And we were very, very grateful that God kept us together as a group the entire time. They never tried to separate us. And so at one point when Mackinson was kind of threateningly taking these steps towards Sam, he stopped right beside Wes. And Wes also spoke very, very good Haitian or Creole, but he didn't do a lot of preaching because he was a little more soft-spoken. But he reached up and he put his hand on Mackinson's shoulder, and he said, and it's a very soft, quiet voice, he said, "Mackinson, you need to be set free." And just like that, Mackinson's anger was gone, and he answered Wes in about that same tone of voice. The Bible does say a soft answer turneth away wrath. And I'm not saying that what Sam was doing was wrong. I think what Sam was doing was right. But it was just interesting the difference in there and how that when Sam would raise his voice, Mackinson would too. When Wes lowered his voice, Mackinson did too. And so they chatted for a little bit. And then eventually, once again, we wanted to go inside the house. So we headed inside the house, and Mackinson didn't try and stop us that time. But he did come inside after us, and he told Sam that he wanted Sam to come back outside with him. And we said, no, he's not going back outside. If you want to talk to him, you can talk to him right here. And after muttering a little bit angrily under his breath, Mackinson did eventually go out the door. And then some of us went to bed, but a number of us stayed up for probably 3 or 4 hours just praying and singing. Some singing, but mostly praying. And once we got to the point where we felt confident and at peace that God would take care of us for the rest of the night, we went to bed. And the next morning, God did definitely take care of us because no one was hurt or anything like that. So the next day, I don't remember what time of the day it was, maybe towards evening, I started hearing this music, drums and other music and chanting in the distance. I didn't really think a whole lot about it, but I did figure it was probably some kind of satanic worship going on somewhere around where we were being held captive there. But I didn't think a whole lot about it because it sounded like it was pretty far away. And that night you could hear it kind of in the distance still. And the next day it was still going, but it was louder. And I remember distinctly thinking that to me it sounded like what happened on Mount Carmel, where the prophets of Baal wanted to pray to Baal and get him to show his power. And Baal didn't. And so they got louder and more noisy and more boisterous, but Baal never showed his power. That's kind of what it sounded like. Because the night after that, which would be the third night after we had first heard the music, I'm laying there, hadn't gone to bed yet. I'm laying there. I wasn't in the doorway anymore. I was across the room this night. But I was laying there, hadn't gone to sleep yet. Or maybe I was asleep and it woke me up. I don't remember. But all of a sudden, I hear this music in the distance again. And as I listen, it gets louder. And I realize that I'm hearing the radio of a vehicle playing. And this vehicle's coming closer. And in fact, the vehicle came up and parked right outside the wall, right across the wall from where we're sleeping. And they opened the doors and turned the radio full volume and just blasted whatever music. And it was not what you would call Christian music at all. Just blasted it at us. And pretty soon, people outside start yelling and screaming. It was all in Creole, so I couldn't understand it. But Melody said that she heard a couple words that she recognized. She said she heard the name Sam Stoltzfu. She heard Cam. She heard a couple other names she didn't recognize. And then they just started screaming one word over and over. Just that word was fall. Just fall, 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 fall. What were they doing? I believe they were trying to put a curse on us. And so I woke up, and I sat up, and I looked over to the doorway of the other room, and there were two people sitting in the doorway, and I assumed they were probably praying. So I just moved over there and started praying with them. And about the time we got done praying, Matt and Rachel woke up and started praying, so we moved in and made a circle with them. And eventually Wes came and joined our circle as well, and there was probably 6 or 7 of us praying. We prayed once again for probably about 3 or 4 hours that night, just praying. And we prayed all kinds of things. One thing we prayed was that God would just shut the radio off. And after probably about 3 to 3.5 hours, all of a sudden, the radio shut off just like that. And of course, we were like, thank you, God, for that answer to prayer. Well, turns out God had used Wes to answer that prayer. Because Wes woke up and heard the music playing. He walked over to the door, and Ping was outside the door laying on a couch. And Wes told Ping, go shut the music off, and Ping went and shut the music off for us. And that next morning, once again, we prayed that night till we felt at peace and felt confident God would protect us. And the next morning, sure enough, Mackinson's pickup was parked outside the wall of the house, and Mackinson was laying over the steering wheel sleeping. So we were definitely in a spiritual battle, but God's power was so much stronger than Satan's power. And he showed it those two nights. Another thing that happened is we started experiencing some health issues at this second spot. Wes got a really bad case of athlete's foot that made so he could barely walk. And Cheryl started getting these sores that she wasn't sure what to call them, but it kind of almost looked like boils, kind of what I would imagine that Job had in the Bible. By the time that Cheryl was released, she had counted these the morning before she was released. The morning before she was released, she counted these, and she had over 40 of these across her hands, her feet, the back of her neck, her arms, her legs, and they were quite painful. We didn't know exactly what they were, but it seemed like every time she got bit by a mosquito or an ant, which was quite often, one of these things would start. And it would grow. I mean, some of them were honestly this big. Quite painful. So she had some, and Kay had a couple on her feet as well. And we didn't know what to do. We had no kind of antibiotic cream of in any way, shape, or form. But one thing that Cheryl had learned from the Kenyans was that if you need something to take out infection, then what you do is you take water and you boil it, unless it's clean. If it's clean, you can use it. But we boiled it because the water we got for showering and that kind of stuff and washing probably came from a river of some sort and was not clean. When you can look down the water and see sometimes little worms wiggling around in the water, you kind of know it's probably not all that clean. But you boil water, and then you take the ashes from the fire and dump the ashes in the water, and then soak the infected whatever it is, wherever it is, soak that in the water. The ashes acts like a natural lye to draw out the infection. So Wes would soak his feet two times a day. Cheryl tried soaking some of her sores in there as well. Wes's feet did slowly heal. They didn't heal immediately, but they did eventually heal, but it took a long period of time. Cheryl's sores never completely healed. But it was interesting because God was working in that, even though he didn't answer our prayers like we had asked, he was working because one thing that we had talked about was escaping from the second spot. And there was a number of us that were against the idea of escaping. I'm not going to say who all was in that group, but I will say I was. I was one of the people involved. And I was probably the most outspoken of the group of people. And about why I didn't want to escape. And you might say, well, why didn't you want to escape? Probably the biggest reason I didn't want to escape is I didn't like what I was hearing the other people say about how they wanted to do it. For example, those 6 boxes of Benadryl that they had given us, they wanted to slip those Benadryl 2 or 3, maybe 4 or 5 pills to each guard one night, and then the next morning when they're all sleeping off the effects of that, you know, we walk off. And to me, I didn't really like that because to me it sounded like they were saying, so let's use our own wits and abilities to get out of here, and then God will meet us outside the camp and take us from there, where he wants us to go. And to me, I would much rather that God put the guards to sleep on his power, we don't do anything, and then we leave. So that was why I wasn't in favor of some of their talking about escaping. And one morning we did actually try it, to a certain extent. Because one morning we woke up, and a couple of us went out earlier in the morning to watch the sunrise came up, and we looked around and realized that all the guards were sleeping. There were 3 or 4 guards just sacked out at various spots around the camp there. And we didn't tell anybody, or we didn't go and wake the rest of the people up, because I think all of us that were outside at that point were all on the side of thinking we weren't supposed to escape. So we didn't tell anybody. But at least right away. But later, some of the others found out, and they weren't angry at us or upset, but they said, if that happens again, well, maybe that's God telling us he wants us to escape. And I hoped it wouldn't happen again, but the next morning it happened again. We got up, and once again, well, this time all the guards except one were gone. And that one guard was fast asleep. And so the ones that wanted to escape woke up and they decided that maybe this is the morning we should escape. And so before we decided to go, we prayed and decided that if none of the guards had woken up or if none of the others had come back by 7:45, we were going to leave. It was 7:30. And I wasn't sure about this. I wasn't sure about whether this is what God wanted us to do. But eventually I got to the point where I could honestly say, okay, if God doesn't want us to, he'll stop us. He'll have a guard come back, or he'll wake this guard up, or something like that. 7:45 rolls around, And one of the guys comes out of the house and he says, "It's 7:45, let's go." And I look out across the field and here come two guards walking across the field towards us. So God very clearly said, no, not that night. A couple days before we moved back, before we were moved again, we started a 24-hour prayer chain. We had three watches or four watches so we could keep track of days and time. And basically, we would just take that watch, we would pass it from person to person, and each person was supposed to take a half hour or so to pray. And we tried to keep this up for 24 hours every day. And we were fairly successful with that. There were a couple of nights where the person with the watch would fall asleep, and so it wouldn't get passed on to the next person. But we did that pretty much from that day to the, till the day God delivered us. So eventually we did get moved back to the first place. We moved back to the original place we were held captive at. And very similar to the way it happened the first time, Mackinson came and said, "We're moving you again." And Sam tried to talk him out of it, but he wouldn't hear it. And so they took everything again. Once again, it was about 45 minutes to an hour, and they were back to pick us all up. And this time, and the first time they had taken us over 17 people plus the driver and Ping in one pickup. In the cab and the bed. So the second time they moved us back, they would not allow any of us in the beds of the pickup. They had two pickups this time, so there was 19 people crammed in two pickup cabs. And when we got back there, same building, same location, one difference, those prisoners that had been in the other room were gone, and now we had both rooms to sleep in. So that allowed you to, you know, eight people to sleep in one room and seven to sleep in the other room. And the first day after we got back, Matt got sick. It wasn't because of his medicine, or the medicine he didn't have, I don't think. It was some kind of infection in his leg. I don't remember what he called it. But he said that he had had this one time before, and he had had to go to the ER for it. And the doctor had told him that this kind of infection, you've got about 18 hours to do something with before it becomes life-threatening. And so we told the guards what was happening, and the guards got a hold of Papa Wheelie Chief, and he came and looked at Matt, and Papa Wheelie Chief called Beanie, and Beanie came and looked at Matt. And long story short, they told Sam they were going to take Matt and Rachel out that night. They were going to release them. Take them to a hospital and release them. And before they left, we prayed. We had a time of prayer for Matt and Rachel, and prayed that God would heal Matt. Once again, we didn't have anything to do to help it. And the amazing thing is that Matt and Rachel were released that night. They were taken to the U.S. Embassy, where they were given a choice of going back to the CAM base or flying to the States. And they chose to fly back to the States. So they were helicoptered to a military base in Cuba, to a hospital there. And Matt and Rachel were in the hospital because of the infection in his leg. Rachel said that when they got back to the embassy that night, Matt was pretty much back to normal. Pretty much back to feeling 100%. They were in the hospital overnight and then flew back to the U.S. And I don't know all the details of their story, of their getting released, but from what I do know, it was a harrowing trip that they had to take in a pickup truck in the middle of the night, not knowing where exactly they were going to end up. And we didn't know what had happened to them. All we knew was what the guards told us, and the guards told us three different things. One guard said they're back at the CAM base. Another guard said they're in the Dominican Republic. And a third guard said they're back in the States. So we didn't know who to believe. We just trusted that God had taken control of that steering wheel when they left and took them where he wanted Matt and Rachel. It was while we were here that that big plane that I mentioned about started circling us. And about every other day that plane would circle us. And then the off days, when it wasn't circling us, it was often the DLP was circling us above. And we did eventually make some signs to wave at that big plane, thinking maybe they might see us or something like that. We had cardboard and charcoal to make some signs. One said SOS and the other one said please help. And we'd wave them at the plane as it went over. And I think it was a day or so before God delivered us out of there, we were doing this. And the plane was circling pretty high above us. And we were waving these signs, and it slowed down and dropped considerably lower and made a slow circle around the camp and then came and buzzed the camp at probably less than 500 feet, this huge plane, and then went back up and started circling at its high spot again. And we figured that they probably had seen our signs, and that was them telling us that they saw us. At least that was what we hoped. Another answer to prayer that happened here at this spot. And this one was an absolutely amazing answer to prayer. I've never seen anything like it before in my life. And, you know, after hearing this story, you might beg the question of, so why doesn't God do this all the time? I don't know. But he did, in this instance, he did something that was just absolutely amazing. One night we're laying there sleeping, and I was sleeping beside Brandon, the 15-year-old boy. And I'm laying there, and his mom shook me awake. And basically she told me that, she said, Brandon is burning up with fever. And I rolled over on where I was sleeping. I was sleeping a foot or two away from him on the mattress, and you could feel his body heat just emanating from his body. He was very warm. I estimate, we didn't have a thermometer, but he probably had 103 or higher fever. And we had nothing to give him. His mom had given him a couple of the ibuprofen or similar to ibuprofen pills before he went to bed, and it had not helped at all. So what are we supposed to do? All we had left was prayer. And I don't want to say that to say that prayer is not important. It is. But when you're in a situation where that's all you can do, it really, really tests your faith. Because we like to know that whatever is going to happen is going to turn out good. But we didn't know. All we had was our faith and prayer. So I woke his older sister up, and his mom and his sister and I prayed for him. Laid our hands on him and prayed for him. And it was absolutely amazing. Because after we were done praying, we kept our hands on him, and you could feel his body temperature going down. And within probably less than 5 minutes, he was no temperature at all. He slept through the whole thing. The next morning he woke up, he was feeling fine. He never had a problem with that again. Why doesn't God do that today? I'm not quite sure. But he did that night. Just an amazing answer to prayer that I've never seen, such a quick answer to prayer. Shortly after that incident, Cheryl and Kay and Sheldon were released, and that was a night that was full of drama as well, because when the guards came to release Cheryl and Kay, they were not planning to take Sheldon. Sheldon was her 6-year-old or 5-year-old, 5 or 6-year-old boy, and I think it was a couple days before she left. She told me that she was not sure what she should do. If they came and gave her the option of leaving, should she go and leave her children there, or should she insist her children go with her? What should she do? And she told me that she had decided that if that happened, that she was going to tell the guards she wasn't going to leave without all her children. Well, the guards didn't really give her a choice. They just showed up one evening and grabbed her and Kay and shoved them into a vehicle, preparing to take them out and release them. And they were not planning on taking Sheldon. This was over the time when I was sick with that food poisoning, so I didn't see what happened. But I can explain the sounds that I heard outside the building. It was chaotic. People were yelling and screaming in Creole, in English. People from our group were commanding these guys to stop in the name of Jesus. They were yelling, there was shouting, and I fully expected to hear gunshots and other kinds of noises. But we didn't. Long story short, God worked another miracle, and they agreed to take Sheldon out when they weren't originally planning to. But before Cheryl left, she asked me, she said, Austin, she said, if they take me out, she said, will you promise to take care of my children for me while I'm gone? Until God takes the rest of you out. And I told her, I said, I promised I would. I didn't know how exactly I was going to, but I said I would as best I could. And that night, when they took Cheryl out, Beanie told Sam that we were all going to be leaving within the next 2 or 3 days, and they were going to take us out in groups of 2 or 3, just like they had taken Matt and Rachel out and taken Kay and Cheryl and Sheldon. That did not happen. And to this day, no one knows exactly why it didn't happen. Because long story short, by this point, Cam had turned the negotiation over to the U.S. government. And so Cam was no longer negotiating with this gang. They had essentially stepped out of it and given the responsibility to the U.S. government. And the U.S. government had negotiated with this gang, and they had agreed on a ransom for us. I don't know who paid it, the person who paid it wants to remain anonymous. I also don't know how much he gave. I do know it wasn't near the $17 million the gang was asking for. But they agreed upon an amount, and it was paid to the gang. And so the U.S. government fully expected this gang would follow through with letting us go. They did not. And that really, really flabbergasted the FBI. First time this gang has not held true to a monetary exchange of money that they've agreed upon. As we found out later, what happened was the gang, Beanie, Papa Wheelie Chief, wanted to let us go. The money had been paid. We can let them go. The guy in prison said, no, you can't. He said, keep using them as leverage to get me out of prison. Once again, the gang was not agreed. They were divided in what they wanted to do, and we were not released as they had said they would. So, moving on now to the night of our escape. And I know time is moving on here quickly, but glad you are being patient. I've told the story a number of times, and I have never stayed within the time limit that people have given me, so I'm really glad Alan didn't tell me I had a specific time limit, because I probably would not have stayed in that time limit. So, moving on to the night that God delivered us. So, one thing, we did talk about escaping quite a bit. We talked about a variety of subjects. When you're with the same people for 62 days, and that's all you have to do to keep yourself entertained, just talk. You talk about just about anything you can think of. As one of them said, it wasn't a question of what we talked about, it was a question of what we didn't talk about. So, we talked about escaping, and one of the guys one day said, maybe we should dig a tunnel. I think he had read the book called The Great Escape, or something like that, and he thought a tunnel might be a good idea. He figured that if things went according to plan, or, you know, went well, we could probably have this tunnel dug in about a month. And this was a couple days into December when he said this. And his plan was to dig a tunnel that would go from one of the rooms under the open spot and come up behind the row of bushes that was surrounding the camp. That was the idea. And once again, I was not in favor of it. I didn't think it was a good idea. My reasons for that are, I still don't know exactly why I felt that way. I just felt that way. And was kind of in a conundrum, because if they started digging the tunnel, should I help them or should I not help them? Because I was or wasn't in favor of it, I wasn't sure. But it turns out we didn't try to dig a tunnel. Because one day we were talking about it, and I just simply asked the question. I said, if we're going to go to all the work of digging a tunnel, I said, why not just skip the tunnel idea and one night decide, okay, we're going to leave tonight. And that night we open up the door and just walk across the clearing in full sight of the guards and leave. If God wants us to leave, the guards won't see us or they won't stop us. And after that conversation, the idea of a tunnel was pretty much dropped. We decided the tunnel wasn't feasible. But we were still kind of unsure on how to escape or when we should escape and all that. And once again, I wanted to get out in a way that let God show his power. I wanted it to be very clear to anyone who heard about it, witnessed it, was there, whatever the case might be, to know that it was God that took us out, not anyone else. Some people might wonder, was the FBI ever planning on coming in and actually taking us out by force? As we found out when we got back to Miami, the FBI was the last resort they were going to use. But when the gang did not hold true to their money agreement, they were actually said they were starting to consider doing a tactical assault. And the fact of the matter is, it wouldn't have been very hard. Those gangsters, they had three guns. But as I already mentioned, the one shotgun had a crooked barrel. It had been used as a pry bar at one point. So the last 4 inches of the barrel were cocked at a couple degrees. But it did shoot, though. They did shoot it a couple times. In fact, they shot it at a passenger plane that was flying over us one day. And so it didn't seem like they really knew how to. They didn't really seem to know how to use their guns that well. I mean, when Ping walks around all day with a pistol stuck in his underwear, you kind of get the impression they might not be all that good with their guns. And the problem is, when they're not that good, they might actually hit you if they shoot at you. And I remember another thing about their guns, another interesting story about their guns is one night, one of the night guards, when they would come, they would have much more sophisticated guns, some ARs and maybe AK-47s. But one of the night guards told one of the day guards, you know, you really shouldn't leave your guns out around where these people could get them, because most white people know how to handle guns. There was five or six of us guys, not myself, but just about every other guy in the group was a hunter or had hunted when they were young. And so that was definitely true. We all knew how to use a gun. And so this guy said, you probably shouldn't leave your guns out and around where these people could grab them. Because one morning we walked outside the house and onto the porch, and the assault rifle was stuck up on the roof of the porch. No guards were in sight. We could have reached up and grabbed it and got a hold of it. A couple days before we left, one of the girls was combing Melody's hair with a fork, by the way. That was our only comb we had, was a fork. So they would use a fork to comb each other's hair. And so she was doing that, and the whole time she was combing Melody's hair, the assault rifle was leaning against the railing of the porch about 6 feet in front of them, no guards in sight. And about the time they got done, one of the guards came out of the room that the guards would use for a bedroom and that kind of stuff. And he saw the assault rifle leaning up against the porch, and he runs over and grabs it and picks it up because I guess he's afraid we were going to take it. Well, it had been there for 45 minutes already. No guards had taken it. So could we have gotten our way out by force? Probably. But none of us wanted to do that. So my point with that is the U.S. government could have very easily come in and taken those guys out, no problem. But were they to do that, we knew that none of the guards would survive, first of all, and none of us wanted to see the guards killed. Some of us would not have minded seeing them running for their lives maybe at times, but none of us wanted to see them killed. You know, what should we do with escaping? Should we go? How should we go? Should we wait? Is God going to get us out by Christmas? He hadn't got us out by Thanksgiving. He hadn't got us out in time for my sister's wedding. Kay had had her birthday while we were down there. Sonia had a birthday while we were down there. Kay's mom had her birthday while we were down there. Wes's grandpa died while we were down there. There were a lot of things that we missed that God didn't allow us to get out for. And so, was God going to get us out by Christmas? That was a big question that we were wondering. And we were hoping and praying that He would. I think it was two nights before we escaped. That's what it was. Two nights before God delivered us, we had a tremendous rainstorm. And I've never seen a rainstorm quite like that here in the States. That whole courtyard between the two buildings was probably covered in 6 to 8 inches of water. It was like a pond out there. And we were inside the house, and someone thought, maybe we should leave tonight. Because whenever it rained, Haitians hate getting wet. So whenever it rained, the guards would all cluster under the porch because there was a roof. And the porch was on the opposite side of the house from one of the doors, and we figured we could probably get that door open and leave. But at the same time, it was raining like crazy. It would have been a muddy, wet walk. And I honestly don't think we would have made it. But that's just my opinion. So, because that night, we went around the circle. They wanted all of us to give our opinions on whether we were in favor of escaping. Because they didn't want to escape unless all of us were agreed. That was kind of something we had talked about earlier. We wanted everybody to be together if we were going to escape. And there were three of us, myself and two other people, that were not in favor of it walking out that night. And the other people said, you know, feel free to share your honest opinion. Don't feel any pressure to say that you want to go just because everybody else does. So we gave our honest opinions. And I remember the next morning, I heard a comment that one of them said. And the comment was, we missed our chance to escape last night. And I remember thinking, okay, no pressure. But I knew that, and I'm not saying this to cast them in a bad light. I believe they were just doing what they thought was right, but at the same time, I was doing what I thought was right too, and they weren't quite meshing. So who was right? I don't know who was right. I'm more than willing to admit that I was wrong if I was wrong, but we just were not unified. And let me tell you, when you're not unified, nothing gets done. It's the same way in church life. Nothing gets done if you're not unified. It just gives Satan a perfect opportunity to try and divide us. And that's what he tried to do with our group. Because the day after that rainstorm, I figured there was probably going to, especially after hearing that comment, I figured there was going to be somewhat of a confrontation between our group, kind of between me and the other two people who were not in favor of escaping that night before and the ones that were. And sure enough, it happened right after we were done praying in our morning prayer. And I won't tell you all the details of what happened, but it ended up with one of the guys looking at me and saying, "Austin, I just don't understand you." Which, to be honest, I didn't either. I didn't know why I was so against the idea of escaping, but I was. I did not feel at peace about it. And so to me and to the other two people that were against it, it felt like Satan was trying to divide us. So that afternoon, we spent probably an hour, hour and a half together inside the building, inside the house, just praying, asking God to please do something. Show somebody. It doesn't have to be us. Just show somebody, what do you want us to do? And the next day, at our 1 o'clock prayer meeting, Ryan told us that morning he had heard God telling him that I want you to take your family out tonight. And what happened that got him to that point, there were a couple of things that got him to that point where he felt like he heard God telling him that. One was, once again, that morning, someone had been combing Melody's hair on the porch, and Melody had been telling this other lady the story about Grant Bontrager. I don't know how many of you know Grant Bontrager, but it's Ryan's cousin who, long story short, his mom was mentally handicapped. She was raped by a worker at a mental care facility. And the doctors told Ryan's grandparents, "You should abort this baby because there is a high percentage chance that this baby is not going to be normal." Because his mom is mentally handicapped. And they decided not to, even though the doctor said do it. They decided, as Ryan said, they chose the hard path, even though they knew it was going to be difficult. His grandparents had three daughters who were mentally handicapped. So they knew what it was like to raise someone mentally handicapped, the work, the effort, the energy. Yet they chose the hard road of saying, "No, we're going to let this baby live." And so Ryan was listening to that story. He was just circling the camp as he was praying, circling the camp, and every time he'd come around where the porch was, he would hear little bits and pieces of that story. And another thing that helped him come to that realization was when this whole idea of escaping via a tunnel had come up, Wes had found out that from the bathroom, where you would go to the bathroom, once again, a spot that was surrounded by curtains on three sides. The fourth side was like just a couple feet from the bushes. And so he found out that you could go in the bathroom, and then without the guards seeing you, you could dive into the bushes. And he made a tunnel through the bushes back in there, just kind of see what he could find. Originally, he was maybe looking for a phone, to find somebody with a phone he could make a call with. But eventually, he was looking for a spot to where this tunnel should come up. And then this next morning, he had dove into the bushes that morning while Ryan was making a circle and praying. And he had found or made a path from the bathroom there all the way down the row of bushes to a mango tree that was right on the edge of the camp. If you could get to that mango tree, you were out of sight of the guards. And so Ryan knew he was in there doing some exploring. And he told God, he said, "God, if you want us to escape..." He said, "Then make Wes come out of those bushes completely against the idea of escaping." Because Wes thought we could was one that thought we could probably escape if we were careful. And Ryan said, "If you don't want us to escape, make him come out completely against it." His wife had prayed the exact same prayer. They didn't communicate, but they had both prayed the exact same prayer. Wes came out of the bushes with a silly little grin on his face, and he said, "Guys, it's totally possible. We can do it." So Ryan told us all this at our 1 o'clock prayer meeting. And then he wanted all of us to give our opinions on it. And as he said later, he said, I wasn't sure how Austin would take this. But so, and that kind of gives you a an idea of somewhat the standing that I was holding in the group at that point. But the amazing thing was is when Ryan told the story and how he had come to that spot of feeling like this is what God wants him to do, I was 100% at peace about it and in favor of it this time. And the other two people that were against it originally were also in favor of it. And so we decided that that night we were going to leave. And one thing that I appreciated about what Ryan said, when Ryan said he was going to leave, he said, I don't think that we should put a lot of fleeces before God. Let's just decide we're going to go tonight and let God work out the details. I said, amen. In my mind, I said, amen, let's do that. So we did what we could. We packed some water, packed Melody's diaper bag. We left anything we didn't think we were going to need and took what we thought we would need. And that night, for our evening prayer, we took the couches and moved them around to the north side of the house. The door that we were going to go out of was on the south side of the house. So we took the couches around to the north side. We hoped that by doing that, that would encourage the guards to all stay on the north side of the house that night. Because the door on that south side was barred. It was barred by a post that was leaning against the top of the door and then a big chunk of concrete against the bottom. So we weren't supposed to open that door. If we ever tried, the guards would very angrily shut the door again. This door was not supposed to be open. There was another door we were supposed to go in and out of. And another detail that was just amazing was that night that it rained. Normally at night there was one or two or more guards in that courtyard between the two buildings. The door that we were hoping to go out of opened into that courtyard. And so if a guard was out there, he'd see us if we opened the door and went out. And one reason they were always outside that door was right outside the door they had fixed up a power strip to one of those tree trunks stuck in the ground. And that's where they would charge their phones at night or their Bluetooth speakers. And so they were always out there at night. Well, the day it rained, that power strip was in the water. At least some of it was. So the next day when the water was down, the guards took it and moved it over to the porch. So now there was no longer any reason for those guards to be in that courtyard. And so we hoped if we moved the couches over there, the guards would stay on that side of the house that night. And then God worked another little detail. Just before we went inside, it started raining. Well, when it started raining, the guards all ran for the porch, and that's what happened again. And it didn't rain for very long, but it rained enough. They all went onto the porch. They moved the couches onto the porch, which is what we were hoping they would do. And we also got one of the most beautiful sunsets I've ever seen in my life that night. We were standing there in a circle, singing and praying, worshiping God, and the sunset was absolutely phenomenal. So we went inside, and we had decided that we were going to wake up at about 1:30 and start seeing if we could figure out if we could get out. And one of our preparations also included smuggling a stick into the house, because we figured that we could take a stick and shove it through the crack in the door and shove that piece of concrete out of the way, and then reach in there and lift the post up enough with that stick so somebody could get their arm out the door and get a hold of the post, and we could slowly work it away from the door so we could open the door. So, one more miracle that God did that night. He did so many miracles that night, it's hard to keep track, hard to count them. But the two nights previous to this, the generator had not been running because it was out of oil. We had told Ping... Wes was a mechanic, so he had looked at it and told Ping that it needs oil. And Ping had tried to get oil, or at least he said he had tried to, but he hadn't come up with any. So for two nights, we hadn't had a generator, and we knew that if we were going to leave and walk through the bushes, it would be nice if there was a generator running just to help cover noise. But we figured that if God wanted us to leave, then if there's no generator, he can take care of covering the noise. So probably about 8 or 9 o'clock that evening, Mackinson showed up. And Mackinson had become, so he was our town runner who was supposed to get us all the stuff we needed, but he was quite unpredictable. If you would tell him you would need toilet paper, you might not get it for 3 or 4 days. Or if you needed toothpaste, you might not get it for 3 or 4 days. But he showed up that night, and he asked why the generator wasn't running. And we told him it's out of oil. And he said, well, I'm going to go see if I can get some oil for you. So he left. And he went to extra pains to get that oil. And within less than probably an hour or hour and a half, the generator was running. Totally out of his character to go to that much trouble for us at that time. Especially after the black bottle incident. Or the black bag incident. So we woke up, in our 24-hour prayer chain, the watch was passed to me at about 12:30 that night. So I prayed, I think it was midnight. And I had it for about an hour. And then I gave it to somebody else. So I decided, you know what, I'm just going to stay up until 1:30 and just see. Just listen. The whole time I was praying, I was listening to the guards outside. There were two things we were hoping for. We were hoping that the guards would be quiet or like kind of asleep. And we were hoping they would all be on the porch. And as I was listening, I realized two things. They were not all on the porch and they were quite active, quite noisy. So 1:30, we started waking up, just trying to figure out, should we or shouldn't we do this? And eventually, long story short, we decided to give this a go. The guards were all on the north side of the house, but there were three of them that were sitting out on chairs that we weren't sure if they would be able to see past the corner of the house where we were going to enter the bushes, where the plan was to enter the bushes. We weren't sure. We thought they just might be able to. So if they could and were looking in the right spot at the right time, they would see us go in the bushes. So we eventually decided, okay, we're going to do this. So we shoved the piece of concrete out of the way. It rolled probably 2-3 feet away from the door and stopped. And the door, where that crack was, had a piece of trim that was supposed to be covering the crack, but it was loose except for one nail. And one of the guys decided to see if he could pull that off. So he pulled it off, and it came off, but it made quite a loud pop when it came off. And Ping heard it. And Ping comes walking around the house to stand right in front of that door. Now remember, the concrete is this far away from the door. Any other time we tried to move that concrete or open that door, the guards had very noisily and angrily shut that door and put the post and concrete back up against it in no uncertain terms. And now Ping's standing out there looking at this door. And I think Courtney was looking out the crack watching as she saw him. And she whispered that Ping was out there. So, and at this point, all 17 of us were standing right on the other side of the door, waiting for the door to be open so we could go. And now Ping's standing right out there. And he stood there for a couple minutes. And then he left without doing anything to the rock. Just left the rock this far away from the door. Another miracle. What happened? Why didn't he do it? I know there are some people that claim that the gang saw us leave and just let us go. I don't think that's the case. Because one time Sam asked Ping, he said, what would happen if we would escape? And Ping said they'd kill me. The gang would kill me because I didn't do my job. So I honestly believe that God worked a miracle there and that Ping never saw that concrete away from the door. I think he saw it still leaning against the door when it was 2 or 3 feet away. And so then he turned and walked away. And we thought, we're like, is he going to come around and chew us out for what we did? So we frantically got all the beds arranged again. Everybody dove into bed, pretend like we're sleeping if he comes in the door. Well, he didn't. He didn't come in the door. And then people are saying, well, is that God telling us that we shouldn't go? And I remember thinking, no. And saying this, I said, no, that's God telling us that we are supposed to go. Because he didn't see that concrete. Any other time, he would have shoved that concrete back against the door. In fact, 2 days before, he had done just that. Or one day before. The night before, he had done just that. Courtney and Sonia had decided, let me back up a little bit. The day before we left, the guards had decided to clean house for us because we had a huge number of ants inside the house that would crawl all over you at night. So they decided to bleach the entire inside of the house to try and get rid of the ants. So they had done that, and they had opened that door we weren't supposed to open. And they had left it open pretty much the whole afternoon to air out the house. And it was still open when we went to bed that night. And so we pulled the door shut and latched it from the inside. And we didn't know this at the time, but Courtney and Sonia had both agreed and they had both prayed and asked God that if that door was still open at 8 o'clock, that we were going to leave. And it was 7:45 when they prayed that, or 7:30. So, and none of us knew this, but I remember we were sitting there, and I saw Sonia lean over to Courtney and say, "It's 8 o'clock." And just as she said that, there was a thump outside the door as that post came back down against the top of the door. And then a couple seconds later, the concrete came, was shoved against the bottom of the door. So why did Ping leave it? I don't think he saw it. I think God blinded his eyes in some way to give us a chance to get out. So I was like, let's go. This is God telling us that we need to go. And well, some of the people still weren't sure about that, so they decided to give it a little bit more time. And we had decided by 3 o'clock, if we weren't out, we were not going to try it that night. Because Sam and Wes, the two who knew Haiti the best and knew roughly where we were in Haiti, figured that we wouldn't have enough time to get far enough away if we didn't get out before 3 o'clock. So if 3 o'clock rolled around, we were going to drop it. And I think it was about 2:15 or 2 o'clock when this whole situation with the door happened and Ping. So everybody laid back down. Well, most people laid back down. I was praying, and I know a lot of other people were praying too. And 2:30 rolled around, and I woke Wes back up or talked with Wes for a while. Wes went and got Sam, and we talked for a while, like, should we go? I'm like, yes, let's go, let's go, let's go. And finally they agreed okay, let's go. So we got the post away from the door just like we had figured we could with that stick, and got the door open and got Wes outside the door. He moved the post out of the way so the door would open easily. The plan was that Wes would go out and just kind of scout around, make sure there were no guards around and see where and so on. And then he would come back to the door, and if he would whisper the word, or if he would say the words "all clear," then that meant we were supposed to go. And we had an order. We had our order figured out. It was Wes, and then Ryan and Melody and their children, and then Cheryl's four children were next, and then me, and then Sam and Dale were the two in the back. And they said their job was when everyone was out the door, Sam and Dale were going to put the post and the stone back against the door the way it had been when we had gone to bed that night. And they did that, and we got into the bushes without the guards seeing us, made our way down the bush line, and got to the mango tree. And there was a little canal that ran along the north side of the camp, and we were on the south side. We needed to cross the canal. So we walked down the canal for a ways looking for a spot to cross. It wasn't a big, wide canal. The guys could have easily jumped across, and the girls might have been able to too, but Ryan and Melody, who were carrying Andre and Laura, weren't going to be able to jump across carrying them. So we were looking for a spot to cross. We couldn't find one, so finally we said, okay, we'll just slog your way across. If you get wet and muddy, so be it. So we did. We helped each other get across and jumped if you could, helped people get across. We did get across. One of the girls almost lost her flip-flop in the water, or in the mud, but we all got across. And God has such a unique sense of humor, because we walked down the canal for probably about another 1/4 mile and found a bridge. But we were already across the canal. So at that point, Wes, who was in front, told Melody, he said, "I'm going to go as fast as I can." He said, "If you can't keep up with me, just let me know and I'll slow down." So we focused on just putting as much distance between us and the camp as we could, taking the path of least resistance across the fields. And that night that we escaped was just an amazing night for a number of reasons. God worked so many miracles that night once again. Anytime we ran into a situation where we didn't know where to go, we would stop, make a circle, and pray, and then start walking, expecting God to show us the path to take. That included God taking us right down Main Street of a village in the middle of the night. But there was no way around the village, and so we had to go right through the middle of it, and God took us through. We didn't see a single person. We saw some animals. So we knew there were people there, but we didn't see a single person. We came to this huge body of water that we hoped wasn't a river. Well, it turns out it was a lake. We went around the lake, and then pretty soon after we got around the lake, we dove into thorns. Just into bushes that were just, it seemed like every tree and bush in that forest had thorns that were this long. And they just loved to poke you. And we had almost a full moon that night, so we had good light, but about the time we got into that forest, the moon was almost set. So we were losing our light, and it wouldn't have mattered anyways. That forest was so dark, you could not have seen If we were in the forest, I could not see Alan if he was that far away from me. He would have been not there. I couldn't see him. That's how dark it was. And so the way of getting through that forest of thorns was made a single file line, and the person in the front would feel their way through the thorns with their hands and make a path. The people behind would follow in single file. If you came to a thorn bush that just was, you know, seemed to grab everybody, then one person would just like step into the branches and just hug all the branches to his or herself so everybody else could go past, and then he or she would fall in at the end of the line and keep going. And we just snaked our way through that forest. We went past cactuses that were probably 16 to 20 feet high. And there were cactuses there that would literally jump out and grab you. And we just snaked our way through this forest, and once again, God worked a miracle, because there were a number of times where we, in that forest, we came to spots where you were just surrounded by thorns. No way to get through. I would like to go back in the daytime and see what we actually walked through, because I will guarantee you, in the daytime, you couldn't find a way through it. But God found a way through in the middle of the night. We came out of that forest of thorns by about dawn, when the sun was coming up. And we were amazingly not very scratched up, not as bad as I thought we should be after coming through those thorns. The sun came up about the time we got to a road. And the road ran parallel with the mountains. And I should say that when we left the camp, we had a direction to travel. Because you could see in the distance on one of the mountains, you could see a landmark. And Sam and Wes recognized that landmark. They knew where it was. And they knew there was a major highway that ran between the DR and Haiti that went beside that mountain feature. So that was where we were headed, was toward that mountain feature. Because they figured that if we could get across that main highway, we would be out of this gang's territory. And so we came out on a road. This road ran parallel with the mountains. So we tried to travel north and west. That was our direction. This road ran east and west, and we decided to follow the road for a while. And once again, God works in amazing ways. Because we hadn't been on the road for much more than probably about 15 seconds. And Melody, who was carrying Laura at the time, tripped and fell. And she fell hard right on top of Laura. And, of course, Laura wakes up and starts screaming. And, I was sure she was hurt. Well, thank the Lord she wasn't. I think Melody twisted her knee maybe a little bit in the fall. But other than that, she was fine, too. But what was so amazing about it is, we're in the middle of this road. We're not, and 12 white people in those circumstances in that place was less than inconspicuous at that time at that place. And Laura screaming her head off. And like, well, what do we do? Well, Dale, who at that time was in the lead, went running ahead a little bit, and he came back and said, hey, he said, there's a cow trail that takes off north. He said, let's get on that cow trail, and she can calm down while we're on there. So we got to that cow trail, and we decided to just keep following it. And the interesting thing is we probably would not have seen that cow trail if Melody hadn't fallen. So even in that situation, God was working. Because we followed that cow trail until we got to within sight of that highway that we were headed towards. And then we were like, so now what do we do? What should we do? Should we try and find a phone? Should we walk down the highway and go find a police station? Because Sam knew there was a police station not too far down the highway, a couple miles. But should we trust the police? I mean, in Haiti, the police might just turn you over to the gang you just escaped from. Who knows? Might. What should we do? So once again, we stopped and we prayed and asked God, what do you want us to do? And I felt like God told me, let's go find somebody with a phone. And so when we got done praying, I said, let's find somebody who'll see if they'll give us a phone to use. Because in my mind, I remember thinking, God brought us out of that camp. He got us this far. He will make so that the first person we find is the person he has designed to help us. And that's exactly what happened. Sam and Wes were given the job of finding somebody to see if they had a phone, because they spoke Creole the best. And so they headed off. We had a prayer. They headed off down the hill and down into a little gully. And right up in the gully there, they found somebody. And they walked up to him and they asked him, do you have a phone we can use? And he said, no. He said, I don't. He said, but if you go to that house, he said, he pointed to one probably a quarter of a mile away. He said, there's a phone there you can use. And when the gang had stolen all our money 62 days before this, Somehow, when they had searched Melody's diaper bag, they had missed $1,500. 1,500 of the Haitian money, which is about 15 US dollars. They had missed it somehow. It was still in her diaper bag. So we had this. And Ryan, Wes and Sam took that with them because, you know, they can thought they could maybe pay somebody to use their phone. And so they got to this house. The rest of us just stayed at the top of the hill there, went and pulled back over the side of the hill so you couldn't see us from the highway, sat down and just prayed. We had our morning prayer. It was amazing because we were free. God had taken us out of there. And that morning, God gave us the most beautiful sunrise I've ever seen in my life. It was absolutely amazing. So Sam and Wes, they got to that house. They saw two guys. They asked them, do you have a phone we can use? And the guy said, yes, we have a phone, but it's out of minutes. You can't call anybody on it. And Sam pulled out $500 of the Haitian dollars and said, could you go buy some minutes? And I said, yeah, there's a place just down the road that sells minutes. And Sam gave him and said, will you go buy it for us? He said, sure, I'll do it. And Sam said, keep the change for your trouble. He was more than happy to do that. So he went, got minutes on the phone, came back, gave it to Sam. Sam called Barry. Barry said, I'm on my way to pick you up. And it was about 25 minutes before Barry pulled up. And that was absolutely amazing to see him and Phil Mast pull up in two different vehicles. We piled in after some hugs and tears, and headed back to camp. And I remember at one point talking with some people in our group, and I was thinking about when we get back to camp. I didn't know at that time when we were going to get back there, but I remember thinking when we get back to camp, it's going to be, I think we're going to have a small picture of what it's like when Jesus comes back the second time and takes us all to heaven. Just that reunion, that joy. And it didn't disappoint. We pulled into the camp base, and the first person we saw when we drove in the gate was Ray, who was the dad of the four children that had been in captivity. He hadn't seen him for 62 days. He was the first person we saw. And he lifted both hands into the air and started jumping up and down and yodeling and running towards us. And that reunion was absolutely amazing. Ray led us people came from everywhere on the camp base, Americans, Haitians. I mean, it was a joyful reunion. And we had a prayer. We thanked God for delivering us. And we got a chance to call our parents. I called Mom and Dad, and I didn't know what the time was, but I woke them up about 5:45 to tell them I was okay. And which they were very, very, very glad to hear, as you can only imagine. And that afternoon then, the U.S. Embassy made the decision that we were all flying out that afternoon, and they took us back to Miami that afternoon in a big, like a DC-130 cargo plane or something like that, one of the ones you load into from this tail. And they flew us back to Miami, and back in Miami we got a chance to get interviewed by the FBI, each of us that was there got a chance to get interviewed, tell our story to the FBI. And, you know, God worked in an amazing way in that whole situation, because his gospel was preached in places where probably never would have been preached otherwise. Because I remember Sam's interview with the FBI lasted for 5 hours. And when he got back, he was just ecstatic. And he was like, he said, I preached the gospel to those FBI agents. I had them in tears across the table from me. So God's gospel was preached even in the FBI building in Miami. And that pretty much wraps up the story. Anybody have any questions you'd like to ask? Yes?
Did anybody get malaria?
No, not that I know of.
Well, that's another answer for you.
Yes.
Is anybody going back to Haiti?
At this present moment, no. The U.S. Embassy and the U.S. government advised all white people to leave Haiti at the time being, and so CAM has pulled out of Haiti for the time being. I don't know if they'll ever go back. I hope they will at some point, but it doesn't look like it'll happen anytime in the near future unless God works another miracle, which he could. He definitely could. And some people have asked me numerous times, would I go back to Haiti if I was given the opportunity? Absolutely. I hope someday we'll see some of those guards in heaven. But we'll probably never know exactly what kind of influence Sam's preaching and our singing has on those guards until we get to heaven. All right, if there's no more questions, that's fine. Thank you for letting me come and tell the story. And I should have said this at the beginning, but this isn't my story. This is just my side of God's story. This is the story of what God did needs to be told. So share it with people. Tell people that there is a God that's just the same as he was in the Bible. He answers prayer. He does miracles just like we saw in the Bible, or we see in the Bible. And I know sometimes it seems like here in the States you don't see miracles. I mean, I had never seen those kind of miracles that I saw down there in Haiti here in the States. Why? I don't know. This is just an opinion I have, and it could be wrong. But if you're in a situation where you need something, where do you go for help? It's easy, and I know I've been guilty of this. It's easy when you have a huge bank account and you run into a problem, you just go there. You take care of it from your bank account. Yeah, you might pray and ask God for it, but then you take care of it with your own method, and God doesn't get a chance to show his power. I don't know if that's the case, but I sometimes wonder. When he's all you have, it really, really is a faith builder and a faith tester. Do you believe when you pray that God's going to answer? I'll give the time back to you.